From high atop Fox News headquarters in New York City, always seeking solutions, never sowing division. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Welcome to the latest moments of the Brian Kilmeade Show. So glad you're here this hour. Andrew McCarthy standing by. We'll do that on Zoom, and we'll have Ben Domenech at the bottom of the hour. A lot going on today, and we'll keep you updated as we just had a press conference with Pam Bondi as she ruled on she's bringing a lawsuit against the state of Maine for allowing trans men to play in women's sports, and she's taking immediate action. The governor standing her ground when the president said, if you continue to violate Title IX, I'm holding back your funding. And she says, I'm going to continue. So the judge ruled that you cannot hold back the funding. So now the Department of Justice took notice of that and are taking legal action. Let's get to the big three.
Number three.
That's what the legislation is about. It's about dignity. Simple dignity. Everyone deserves to be treated with dignity.
Yeah, Biden is back and more incoherent than ever. Is this the messenger and message that Dems want as he makes outrageous claims about Trump and Musk? Meanwhile, socialist Bernie and AOC are attracting big crowds across the country. Is that the winning counter message to Trump's GOP? Socialism?
Number two.
There is a chance that the money from tariffs could be so great that it would replace, you know, in the old days, about 1870 to 1913, the tariffs were the only form of money.
Tariff drama continues and a new game plan emerges for the Trump team. Cut better trade deals with the world and demand our partners isolate China, who is holding our material for batteries, bombs, and pharmaceuticals soon. Can you say superpower showdown?
Number one.
I don't even know if we announced this, but I am planning tomorrow to go to El Salvador to work to bring him home. The Trump administration themselves, that he was wrongfully abducted from the United States.
What a hero. I'm going to go visit an MS-13 guy that was here illegally. Crackdown on colleges and illegals as the Trump administration in a standoff with the Ivies and with the illegals as Dems astoundingly go to bat for an illegal gang member, not an American citizen. Joining us now to tap into his legal knowledge, Andy McCarthy, Fox News contributor, former assistant U.S. attorney for the Southern District of New York, best-selling author. Andy, are you surprised that Senator Chris Van Hollen will be going to bat for Kilmer Albergo? This is a guy that was scooped up in 2019, came here illegally by his parents at 16, was arrested outside a Home Depot in Prince County by a Prince County officer who realized he was here illegally, handed him off to ICE, and he served a notice to appear, and the judge ruled in 2019 he was a member of MS-13. That's the foundation that has him now in El Salvador. Your thoughts about the senator going down there?
Well, first of all, that's not a complete description of what happened. First of all, he wasn't found to be a member of MS-13.
What did the judge say?
Detained. The judge said that he was going to be detained because that was the issue. The issue was not his membership in MS-13. His issue was whether he could be out on release during removal proceedings. And ultimately, the immigration court not only gave him withholding of removal, which means he could be deported any place in the United States, any place in the world, rather, because he was an illegal alien, but he couldn't be deported to El Salvador because the immigration court found that he had a fear of persecution there. I wasn't very convinced by the evidence that he presented, but that's what the immigration court said. The Trump Justice Department failed to appeal that ruling, so that order is still binding, which is why the Trump Justice Department told the Supreme Court 2 weeks ago that it was illegal for him to be sent to El Salvador. Now, do I think people should be going to El Salvador to champion this guy? No. But, everybody admits that he shouldn't have been sent to El Salvador. How whipped up you want to get about that is a different
story.
Couple
of things. This judge, Elizabeth Kessler, said she was. She says that he was a member of MS-13, and he was afforded a hearing. There was afforded another hearing that was in April. Then December 29th, he was in front of another judge where they appealed the ruling that says he should be kicked out of the country. And then he applied for asylum right there. And then when applying for asylum, he also asked, hey, by the way, if I don't get asylum, don't send me back to El Salvador. What was incorrect about what I said?
First of all, again, the finding that he was a member of MS-13 was not like an adjudicated proceeding where he was accused of being a member of MS-13. He was seeking release on bail in connection with his deportation proceedings. When I used to prosecute terrorists and mafia guys, I would go to bail proceedings before we went to trial and say they were terrorists and mafia guys. The judge would deny them bail. That didn't prove that they were terrorists or mafia guys. I still had to go to trial and prove that. What happened in this case?
Okay, can I just stop you? Can I just stop you right there, Andy? If you said something like that, you had, let's say, Sammy the Bull, and you're like, "Yeah, this guy's on the mafia, and I'm going to bring this case forward." Okay, you wouldn't just say that. You're a responsible person, a man of the law. You said that because you believe that he was a member of the Gambino crime family. So why would this judge say something if they didn't believe it's true?
My saying it in the context of a bail hearing where the issue is not membership in MS-13, the issue is does he get released or not? The issue in a bail proceeding. So then the fact that I, in a bail proceeding, say Sammy the Bull is the deputy head of the Gambino family, that makes him the deputy head of the Gambino family. We can skip the trial and we don't have to do any of that.
Good point. So let me stop you there. You said that because you don't believe he should be out on bail, let's say.
Correct.
And the judge goes, when I'm factoring whether this person, Kilmer, should be out on bail, well, what does he do? Is he just picking crops? You know, is he a construction guy? Or is he a member of MS-13? The judge goes, well, I think it's a dangerous situation because he's a member of MS-13, or I think MS-13 is a dangerous group. Like, that matters.
All right, well then, skipping ahead in the removal proceeding, the final judge decides he can't have asylum because it's time barred. You have to bring an asylum claim within a year. This was like 7 years later. But the judge does give him withholding from removal because she finds that he has a fear of persecution if he gets returned to El Salvador. The Trump Justice Department not only doesn't appeal that, it also allows him to be released on bond on conditions, and he is allowed to be at liberty and to work in Maryland. Now, does the fact that they took that position to you mean that he's not MS-13? Because it seems to me to be very peculiar to take that position if you've decided he's MS-13 and he's an illegal alien.
So there's an inconsistency with the ruling and the fact that the judge said that they believe that he's a member of MS-13. Is that what you mean? That if the judge really believed that you wouldn't let him out?
Well, what I'm trying to get across is that this was about release. It wasn't about his membership in MS-13. Now, if they had evidence that he was a member of MS-13 and they had indicted him and charged him with some MS-13 crime, we wouldn't be having this conversation because it would be proved that he was a member of MS-13. But the point is, that came up in a bail proceeding. And he may be a member of MS-13. He may not be a member of MS-13. I don't know. The federal courts who've looked at this in the last month have all said the government's evidence from 2019 was very weak. And they've also noted that even though this guy's been released since 2019 and it's now 6 years later, the government hasn't brought a single additional fact that would lead you to believe the guy is an MS-13.
And you know why, though?
I don't know.
Because you had a president that couldn't care less about illegal immigrants, had no interest in that. And you have another president that says this guy's listed as somebody. I believe, is he also on a removal order?
To be clear, what happens in a removal proceeding, removal means you can be deported, right? Yeah. So he has removal, but the caveat in his removal is that the judge gave him withholding of removal to Salvador.
Okay.
Which means he could be deported any place, but he can't be deported to Salvador. Now, just so you know, there's a procedure by which the attorney general can try to get that holding reversed, because immigration judges are not Article III federal judges. They work for the Justice Department. But it's very hard to do because it's 6 years ago.
So this is what Stephen Miller said yesterday. Cut six.
Senator Van Hollen seems to be under the very confused impression that this MS-13 terrorist is his constituent. He is President Bukele's constituent. He is President Bukele's citizen. He is President Bukele's resident. He is not a Maryland man. He is not a Maryland anything. He is an illegal alien from El Salvador with a deportation order from the United States. He is not legally even allowed to be in our country.
Is he right?
No, he's wrong. He's got withholding from removal. Yes, he's an illegal alien, and he should have been deported someplace. But Steve keeps not mentioning that there's an order that says you can't send him to El Salvador. The Trump Justice Department told the Supreme Court 2 weeks ago, we acknowledge he should not have been sent to El Salvador. It was illegal to do that. I don't know why they keep leaving that out. It's not it doesn't change whether he's an MS-13 guy or not.
So Andy,
but they screwed up.
So you agree with everything. He removed all the order except for the country he was sent to.
Correct.
Okay.
It's not whether I agree or not.
No,
Brian,
I know.
What the law says.
Right. So here's another what he also brought up, Stephen Miller. He's not an attorney, but he said that since that time, and this is legitimate, the president of El Salvador has done the astounding thing of arresting every single MS-13 person. You can actually walk the streets in El Salvador, say for the New York City. So if that threat is gone, does that change anything about his life being in danger if he goes back to his country?
Yeah, I would even go further, Brian. What I understand is that President Bukele has eliminated the terrorist organization or the gang in Salvador that was the source of Abrego Garcia saying that he was fearful of persecution. So that threat is no longer there. But the issue is, it's then up to Attorney General Bondi to try under federal immigration law to reopen the withholding of removal order by saying that the conditions in Salvador have changed, so the order should be vacated. We don't have any indication that she's done that. Now, I'm not trying to take a crack at Bondi over this, because it's a very hard thing to do when an order's been in place for 6 years to get it reversed. I'm not suggesting that this would be an easy thing to do. But what you're talking about, the change conditions in Salvador, could be a basis to try to get that order removed. But they have to go through the process of doing it. They can't just like blink their eyes and say conditions in Salvador have changed, so we're going to ignore the fact that this order is in place.
Understood. Okay, so they're going to see what happens. But the removal order, MS-13, regardless, the fact is MS-13 not being a threat on the streets of El Salvador anymore could change things, but you want to see the legal procedures happen. I got to bring it to something else. Over 500,000 people are in this country because they got special dispensation because they're from Cuba, Nicaragua, Venezuela.
Right.
And maybe Haiti. I think Haiti.
There's a fourth.
Right.
Haiti.
So it's over 500,000 people. A judge has ruled that, yeah, you can kick them out. One by one, they got to be deliberated against. We all know that's not practical. So if you're the federal government and you want this to end, that's a previous administration's policies, which, in my opinion, have been one failure after another. Where do you go from here? You can't possibly deliberate 500,000 people and still have courts for everybody else in America.
Brian, this is why I said that I thought Biden should be impeached over the border security collapse. The reason I said that is not just that it compromised our security. As somebody who was a government lawyer for a very long time, I understood what a catastrophe Biden was making for us in terms of these millions of people who were let in when there is a process for removing people. and you have to go through the process. That's why it was so profoundly a dereliction of duty for Biden to do this in the first place. But you can't have a country where you can just like sort of scoop people up and kick them out. It was utterly illegal for Biden to let these people in. But, you know, I mean, you have due process protections in this country. I don't know what more to say about it than that.
But you, I mean, I could declare anybody. Everybody in France, you can stay here as long as you want. I think it's in oppressive conditions over there, the socialism. And then I come in as president. I go, I don't want to do this for France. Tough. One by one, every French person that came here has got to be deliberated separately. So there's really nothing you could do legally?
Well, yeah, Congress could give the executive branch the resources and the expedited legal proceedings it would need to get rid of people rapid fire. But they haven't done that.
Wow. So they got to go ask Congress to do it. And they got to get 60 votes in the Senate. And that'll
Brian, there's 20 million illegal aliens in the country. Do you know how many detention spaces Congress has?
How many?
Given us 47,600.
Unbelievable. Yeah. Well, at least there's some rapid change going on right now. Andy McCarthy, thanks so much. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Brian.
All right. Fun talk. Ben Domenech, spot on the hour. Your calls next. You can write me, briankilmeade.com. A lot going on. We'll discuss it all. Don't move.
Illuminating, intriguing, inculcating.
I know some of these words.
It's Brian Kilmeade.
I'm Ben Domenech, Fox News contributor, editor-at-large of The Spectator, and editor of the Transom.com daily newsletter. I'm inviting you to join in-depth conversations every week on the Ben Domenech Podcast.
Listen and follow now at foxnewspodcast.com. If you're interested in it, Brian's talking about it. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Hey, we are back. We have a lot going on today, including yesterday I thought was noteworthy. They had a Situation Room meeting in the White House that lasted a while about Iran. Now, keep in mind, after that meeting in Oman, it was cordial, 45 minutes, they're going to meet another meeting in Rome. But they're still talking about degrading their enrichment facilities, downgrading their uranium. It's at 67% now. It's very close to bomb level. They want it down to 3%. But nobody thinks that that would work because they know they're not trustworthy. They don't allow inspections there. They have to dismantle and discard. That's it. And what was emerging from that meeting is extremely concerning. And they really believe that they are so close to a bomb. When they get one, they get eight. And if they get eight, everything changes. And Israel's not going to wait. So this all leads me to believe, with the missile defense destroyed, Hezbollah on flat on its back, Hamas on a respirator, this is the moment. Houthis have already been diminished, even though the strait is not reopened. This is the moment. And meeting in Rome and going over things, you just got to let them know the circumstances. And it's got to be, we can't drag this out, because if the Iranians drag it out, they win. They get the bomb. And then all changes. What if China comes out and says, we have a mutual defense pact with Iran? What if Russia says the same thing? You hit them, you hit us. Right now, none of that exists. And they have no bomb. I can't tell you if the spring, I could say that a little bit later in April or May.
Radio that makes you think. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
As a United States Senator 400 years ago, and I'd never seen hardly any black people in Scranton at the time, when I was only going in fourth grade. And I remember seeing the kids going by at the time called colored kids on a bus going by. That's what the legislation is about. It's about dignity. Simple dignity.
I mean, is there anything more aggravating than listening to him? I mean, even when he was president, ever as a senator, just a guy that drones on, stood for nothing. And now as a president, so much damage done, trying to fix all at once in 4 months is Trump. Even if he's not running the perfect game or the game that you thought, at least he's president. And now he's out there making up stories about Social Security being stopped or diminished, or less efficient under Trump than him. He fixed it. Really? It's bankrupt within 5 years. So he's back. Is anybody happy about it? Ben Domenech, Fox News contributor, editor at large for the Spectator World, host of the Ben Domenech podcast. Ben, what do you think about the comeback of Joe Biden?
You know, I mean, who is this for? Who is asking for this, Brian? Right. I mean, I don't think that there's any American who is like, you know, what we really need is we need to get Joe out there again, including within the Democratic Party. I mean, it's just, it's pathetic. It's sad. It's just like, come on, man, just enjoy your sleepy time out on the beach. Don't, you know, it's, there's no reason to come back here and scare people. The other thing is, of course, as you know, Social Security is notoriously inefficient. And as you just said, it's running out of money. It has to be addressed. It's a basic math problem, but it's also a problem in terms of the people who are supposed to be doing the job of making sure that people don't get Social Security money who don't deserve it, which clearly is something that is going on and, you know, has to be a major part of addressing it. You know, addressing waste, fraud, and abuse involves things like this. And it's the kind of perspective that lives within the Democratic Party that basically says any dollar going out the door from the federal government is sacrosanct, that it, you know, it just automatically is the thing to do. And we've seen it play out in the course of these coming, you know, in the past couple of months, to a degree that I don't think we've ever seen before in terms of how much they are willing to sort of go out there and say, you know, every single dollar that goes out is a good thing. And of course, the American people are—they're wise to the fact that this is not true. This is not, you know, something that is efficient. This is not the way that we want our money to be spent. And of course, you know, given the fiscal challenges that we have in front of us, it's something that needed to be addressed a long time ago. Congress should have done it. They didn't do it, and now it's happening in a different way.
Well, we watched Brett's interview with the CEOs, these experts, efficiency expert of Doge, not just Elon Musk. But one of the guys said that he was fascinated to find out Social Security, one of every four calls is a fraudulent call looking to get somebody to switch their bank account to an out-of-country source. So there's fraud there. Who said that the federal government is a lean machine that can't be accessed? What is talking about?
Well, and keep in mind, and Brian, I know you know this, in the old days, government efficiency was something that was truly bipartisan, and you had – you know, people like Bill Clinton and Al Gore, who understood that, you know, frankly, if we're going to make the case for these massive government programs, we also have to make the case that they should be efficient and that they should work for the people who are paying into them and not be something that is a source of fraud, because they viewed that as paired together. You know, if we're going to have these big programs, then we're also going to have to make sure they work for the American people. And now that's something that Democrats have completely forgotten. They're just the party of free money. And that's, you know, the simple fact is that these are problems that have been needing to be addressed for so long. I'm glad that the Trump administration is doing them. And for Joe Biden to come out and make it, I mean, of all things, to make it about this, it's like, you know, if it was a foreign policy issue, if it was something where he felt like he could actually be helpful in some way, if he was going to sort of give an olive branch to people in the wake of everything that went down with the ignoble end of his presidency, you know, that's one thing. But in this case, he's just coming out and being a political critic.
Yeah, you want to hear this?
And it's ridiculous.
Most people missed it. And you should feel yourself lucky. But this was important. This was an element that I think is noteworthy. Cut 27.
Republicans, or these guys, are willing to hurt the middle class and the working class in order to deliver significant greater wealth to the already very wealthy. Who in the hell do they think they are? It's never been this divided. Granted, it's roughly 30%, but it's a 30% that has no heart.
I mean, think about it. This is the guy who called them garbage, you know, people garbage, right? And there he goes again. Republicans who got most of the working class vote are for the middle, are looking to hurt the middle and working class to deliver tax break for the wealthy. Do you know what the dialogue right now in this country is? Should the Republicans, for the first time in my lifetime, maybe ever, raise the rate on from 37 to 38% or 39%?
What's Don't say that again. About? You're going to give Larry Kudlow a heart attack.
True. And you, Ben.
Yes, me too. But it's one of these, it is one of these things where you see that conversation, you realize that Joe Biden has not just been out of it for a long time. He's been out of it to a greater degree than I think we ever appreciated. And we're only going to learn more about it going forward. One thing, though, that I do think is really important to keep in mind is that the reason that the president has had to move so quickly in these first 4 months in office is because things were so bad. Things were much worse, I think, than the American people appreciated at the time. The media ran all types of interference for the Biden administration. It wasn't just about Joe Biden's incapacity. It was about the things that they were doing, too. It was about the state of the situation on the border. It was about everything. And I think that what we've seen is that things are much worse and much less stable than even we thought at the time. And it's one of the reasons that President Trump is back in the White House.
I want you to hear Rahm Emanuel. See, to me, and very curious to get your opinion on this, Republicans should worry about the Fetterman, Bill Maher mindset and the Whitmer before she covered her face and embarrassed everybody. When she goes, I want to work with him where I can. He got a lot of people in my state, and I'm going to let you know where I can't. I think that's the winning message that would get Republicans angry. The Bernie Sanders, AOC, Bill, Joe Biden are a gift. And Rahm Emanuel might be running for president, but he seems to be in the Maher camp. Listen to this, cut 28.
To me, from a pure Democratic Party interest, I'd rather focus both on voices and people thinking about the future, how they're going to fight for the American dream in the middle class of this country. Obviously, President Biden has a lot to shed on the moment, but I do, as you probably just strategically, and you saw it the other day, President Trump is still kind of drafting off of Joe Biden. And I think it's important not to have that kind of counterpoint because that's what he's using for his own presidency and his own justification.
And he went on to say we need new voices. And obviously there's two books out, probably three shortly, that all talk about how he wasn't even able to do the job. He might be mentally deficient right at this moment. I mean, I couldn't make it. He talks in cursive. One word just strings next to each other. I mean, he's not well.
Rahm Emanuel is one of the smarter Democrats in the party, which is one of the reasons why I think Republicans should be hoping that they don't listen to him and that they don't listen to what Bill Maher is saying, that they don't listen to what John Fetterman is saying, because you're completely right. That is the kind of appeal that can break through, I think, to a lot of working class and middle class Americans. And look, Brian, I think that there is a problem for the Republicans that they need to anticipate going forward, which is that the Democrats have already made clear what their plan is for this midterm election and for the elections that are coming up. And that is that they want to hang Elon Musk around the neck of every single Republican and make them look as if they are working for the interests of a billionaire as opposed to the interests of the American people. And the reason they're doing that is because Donald Trump is more popular than they expected. His approach has been more popular than they expected, especially when it comes to issues like the border. And so because of that, they are flailing around looking for something else to do. And basically what they're coming up with is blame this billionaire who is, you know, seems less normal and more out of touch. Because, of course, I mean, you know, he's a brilliant nerd. You know, it's like, of course, he's not going to have as much in common with the American working class and the like. But that's something that Republicans need to anticipate. Every Democrat is telegraphing this, and that how they navigate it and make clear that they work for the interests of the middle class and the working class in America, that they're not beholden to a billionaire, that they'll agree with Elon when he's doing things like fighting for fiscal sanity and responsibility in government, and that also they're going to prioritize the needs of their voters above anybody else. That's something that I think they need to be prepared to argue, and I'm not sure that they've fully understood that quite yet. But it's definitely coming. We can already see them telegraphing.
The one thing nobody knows for sure is how the tariff thing is going to come out. And I'll talk about that. It looks like China is going to crack down and maybe hold back our pharmaceuticals. They're already holding on to magnets and metals there, which are going to affect our bombs and our iPhones. So we're already getting some of that right now. They stop purchase orders on Boeing jets because I guess they're going to go Airbus. And we are in turn upping tariffs, that looks like, to over 200%. And we're also telling everyone we're cutting deals with, I think they're going to announce Japan shortly, that's, you know, curtail your dealings with China. So this is really amping up. And that's going to be interesting to see how it plays out. But I think a huge winning one, Ben, and you hang out with a lot more Ivy Leaguers than I do, and I'm being serious, is what they're doing right now with these elite institutions. And they're taking them on, head on, not in a theory or in a debate, no, directly, and saying, if you don't do what I say, I'm holding back billions of dollars of funding. Here's Bethany Mandel. And a lot of it is the anti-Semitism. It began with that. The anti-Semitism still raging on campus. Cut 13.
Jewish enrollment at Harvard is lower than when it was when there were quotas. So the situation at Harvard did not happen overnight. It's been a really low simmer at Harvard for Jewish students for a while. I'm glad that we finally have a president who's dealing with it, because you know it's crazy that Jewish students don't feel welcome at one of the top universities in the college in the world.
So that horrible upper class the Republicans, these horrible rich people, detached, are the ones fighting against the elite institutions and taking on tariffs with guys with hard hats behind them in the Rose Garden. Now, think about this if you're a consultant, Ben, how different things are.
Yeah, no, it's a dramatic shift. And look, we are well overdue in terms of a reckoning for these major institutions of higher education that have, relied on the fact that they are tax-exempt entities that have enormous budgets, enormous foundations behind them, and they are enormously powerful, not just in America, but in the world. You know, as you said, these are the premier institutions of higher learning. People come from all around the world to go to these places because of the prestige that's associated with it, and that's something that I think, you know, they have quite frankly squandered in recent years, as they have turned against free speech, as they have turned against the types of discourse that they used to uphold as being key to a liberal education. And then, as always, you know, I think we have to get back to this anti-Semitism issue, because they have been completely complacent and at times even encouraged the kind of activity that we've seen happen on these campuses, which is absolutely abhorrent and has no place in American society,
right,
let alone in these institutions of higher ed. I will say that I think this is a project that we have to applaud people like Chris Rufo and the Manhattan Institute and all these other people who anticipated a long time ago that this was going to get much worse, much faster than I think certainly I and others had thought, that this was something that we saw it as a burgeoning problem that was at a simmer, and they saw that it was about to turn into a boil, and they were right. And that's something that I'm glad this new administration is taking on.
I'm a little late, but Princeton's president had an interview on The Daily, the New York Times, and as he's talking about how they need to fight back and they have diversity of thought, he said, except for when it comes to things like vaccines, when it comes to vaccines and climate change, we have no interest in the other side. He basically said that. At which time the New York Times reporter said, you know, that's what conservatives are saying. That's not right. He goes, well, no, there is no right. Vaccines work. And climate change is real. So do you understand what you know this, but the audience should understand what we're dealing with. This is not going to be easy.
We are not dealing with a circumstance where these institutions are welcoming even of conservative faculty and people who are, you know, who are still at these places, who have tenure, are basically these last holdouts. I mean, John McWhorter at Columbia, you know, he could not get hired today, I don't think, you know, just because of the stance that he takes when it comes to free speech and the way that we use language. And he's not someone who's even, considers himself a conservative. So it's one of these things where, look, these campuses, we always knew that they were going to be places that were not going to be welcoming to conservatives, but they at least espouse the idea that there could be discourse, that there could be argument, that there could be debate, and they don't even do that anymore.
It's crazy, but I just love it. I never thought within four months, he'd be this aggressive after something that needs to be addressed so fervently. Look, I don't love that the government's going to say check with me on your curriculum. I don't love that, but I understand you got to do some severe things to get some gradual change, to get some massive change, rather. Ben, thanks so much. Appreciate it.
Great to be with you.
All right, back in a moment.
It's Brian Kilmeade. Breaking news, unique opinions. Hear it all on the Brian Kilmeade Show. Sponsored by Prevagen. Prevagen, made for your brain.
Do you remember the Reebok pump, by the way?
Yeah.
Okay, so I worked at Reebok as an intern my senior year in college because Tim's dad was like, what are you going to do with
Tim
this
Hasselbeck.
Art major? Tim Hasselbeck, my husband. He said, what are you going to do with this art major? And I was like, I don't know, I'm going to paint. And he just kind of looked at me like, I think you need a job. And so he was so kind. I was dating Tim at the time. And what I didn't realize was this NFL Super Bowl winning tight end, right, who is as tough as nails, 6'8", muscle, just strength. He was a painter in college. So he knew. He's like, girl, you're going to need a job. So he's like, why don't you?
That's his dad.
That's Tim's dad.
For the Patriots and Raiders, right?
Don Hasselbeck, yes. And so he was looking out for me. And I thought, well, why would he say this? So he worked at Reebok at the time. He's like, I've seen your drawings. Why don't you try to get an internship? Well, I worked for Steve Monty, who designed the Reebok pump. And remember the shroud? Remember when the football cleats had that, like, it was called the shroud. It was like, instead of spatting, they would like cover the laces.
Okay.
And he was like a Geppetto to me. He taught me how to be the architect of a shoe. And my senior year, I designed a cleat for my softball team that I wore.
Wow.
I know. Then Puma hired me and I had some good shoes and some bad shoes.
So that was Elizabeth Hasselbeck. Got the sad news yesterday that Don Hasselbeck, her father-in-law, passed away at the age of 70. So he was an unbelievable player with the Patriots, won a Super Bowl with the Raiders. The dad of Tim and Matt Hasselbeck. Tim's her dad, her husband. And Matt was he was a really good quarterback, Tim, and at Boston College, and then over with the Giants and a few other teams. And then Matt was a long time with the Seahawks. So father passed away. They're coaching actually together at a school in Nashville, and along with some other Super Bowl champions and NFLers. So that school is quite lucky to have high school coaches like that. And, of course, the Hasselbeck sons are on those teams. But that is kind of sad news to pass away at the age of 70. He was a diverse guy who was, I've met him a couple times. He was just huge. But that was sad news. The other news going on, which is relatively good news, is that Fox has won the daytime and primetime, almost doubling all competition. So, you know, Fox has been lucky enough to be number one between that and ESPN really for the last 10 years. But now it's total daytime ratings. It almost triples MSNBC. It's in second. ESPN total day is a third of what Fox News is. Primetime, it's more than double number two MSNBC. And ESPN is third. You would have to, if my math is correct, which is not great, it is basically triple ESPN, HDTV, and TNT. All beat CNN. So CNN is buried in fourth in day and sixth in primetime. We'll keep it here. OutKick some got some good news. They're up 20% year to year. You listen to the Brian Kilmeade Show. So glad you're here.
News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan. It's the fastest growing radio talk show. Brian Kilmeade.
So glad you're here. Brian Kilmeade Show moving through. A lot going on today. We are going to speak with Josh Hammer at the bottom of the hour, senior editor at large at Newsweek, author of a new book called Israel and Civilization, The Fate of the Jewish Nation and the Destiny of the West. As we find out, the Grand Ayatollah, if I was just to paraphrase, put out basically death to Israel yesterday. Really? So you're talking to the U.S. about denuclearizing your country. We're supposed to take you sincerely, and there's emergency meetings in the Situation Room, and you want to know if where your focus is, and then we'll be taking your calls, too. There's just also other news. The Justice Department is going to be suing the state of Maine because they refuse to stop trans men for playing in boys and men's sports. So now it's time to sue to make sure they're Title IX compliant. So let's get to the big three.
Number three.
That's what the legislation is about. It's about dignity. Simple dignity.
Who is he yelling at? Biden is back and more incoherent than ever. Is this the messenger and message Dems want? Meanwhile, socialist Bernie Sanders and AOC getting big crowds. But is socialism what they want to run on? What is the message, the counter message to the GOP?
Number two.
There is a chance that the money from tariffs could be so great that it would replace, you know, in the old days, about 1870 to 1913, the tariffs were the only form of money.
That was the story. It probably won't be the story today, but it could make a difference. Tariff drama continues and a new game plan emerges for the Trump team. Cut better trade deals with our allies and the world and demand our partners isolate China. Meanwhile, China has come back at us with holding back materials for batteries, bombs, and possibly pharmaceuticals. Can you sue, say, superpower showdown?
Number one.
I don't even know if we announced this, but I am planning tomorrow to go to El Salvador to work to bring him home. The Trump administration themselves, that he was wrongfully abducted from the United States.
That is so interesting. Senator Van Hollen thinks it's time to go to bat for illegal immigrants. crackdown on colleges as illegals head the Trump administration in a standoff with the Ivies and with the illegals as Dems astoundingly go to bat for one illegal gang member in El Salvador who's from El Salvador. It's crazy. And I'll just give you an idea. I know you've heard a lot about this case. Kilmer Albergo Garcia, who came here when he was 16. His parents brought him here. In 2019, he was arrested. Excuse me. He was taken into custody by the Prince County officers and handed over to ICE because they found out he didn't belong here. He's from El Salvador, at which time a judge, when hearing his case, said this guy's likely affiliated and verified a member of MS-13. He's here illegally. And then they came back 6 months later and they said, what do we do with this guy? And he says, well, if you throw me out before you do that, I'd like to apply for asylum. And if that doesn't work, whatever you do, you have to send me out of the country, don't send me to El Salvador. Well, in 2025, he got sent to El Salvador because Trump's in charge and an affiliation with MS-13. That's when the battle started. And that's what everybody thinks. This is what's worth for Democrats, to fight for that guy over the fact that you have a situation where Rachel Morin, in the same state of Maryland, had a jury returned murder conviction on a legal immigrant who brutally murdered her, a mother of five who was jogging. So let's not help them. Let's find that illegal immigrant who you think doesn't belong back in his home country of El Salvador, who has ties to MS-13, and the judges and many who know him say he's a member. Listen to Patty Morin on the misplaced focus of Democrats. Cut five.
I'm very angry. I'm actually outraged, but I'm too sad at the moment to show anger at the same time. There was no action on the Democratic Party in any way from Joe Biden, Kamala Harris, Mayorkas, anyone here in Maryland. None of the senators did anything to help search for the murderer of my daughter.
Yeah, that's true. But guess what? Senator Van Hollen of Maryland thinks he knows what he wants to do. Cut one.
I don't even know if we announced this, but I am planning tomorrow to go to El Salvador to work to bring him home. The Trump administration themselves admitted in federal court that he was wrongfully abducted from the United States.
They didn't say abducted, number one. Number two, you keep saying your constituent. He didn't vote for you. He's not a citizen. What don't you understand about that? Meanwhile, a federal judge says you have to go out of your way to help this guy get out of El Salvador. At which time, Stephen Miller comes back and says, why would we do that? He's from El Salvador. The president there I can't just tell that president to take a citizen and throw him into America, even if it seems like that's where he wanted to be. And also, MS-13 has been declared a terrorist group. Will we bring terrorists back to our country? And MS-13 is a threat to him? Not in El Salvador. When they made the ruling, El Salvador was being run by MS-13. Now they've been rounded up and jailed in the same prison he's in. Here's Stephen Miller, cut seven.
Under the due process that these Democrats so venerate for illegal invaders, it is legally impermissible for him to have one more minute in this country. So we honored the law and obeyed the law by getting him out of this country. And if the entire Democrat Party was to work itself into a state of emotional hysteria to demand the return of illegal gang members and terrorists to our shores, then that 21% will soon be 15, and then it'll be 11, and then all they'll have left is the support of actual confirmed MS-13 members, and that will be the entire base of the Democrat Party.
So this is where we're standing right now, and that's their focus. Good luck with that. That's like saying, I'm going to go to bat for trans men in women's sports. Are you crazy? 90% of the country want no part of that. The 10% that do are probably don't have any daughters and sisters or have a mom that ever played competitive sports and they've been steamrolled by a guy on the soccer field or field hockey pitch or basketball court or even got spiked in the head by in volleyball. So we'll see where that goes. I also love what's happening at these Ivy League institutions. They're being called to the carpet for allowing anti-Semitism to take root and to flourish, basically unencumbered. Also, it's a bastion of liberal thought, extreme liberal thought. And anti-Americanism has emerged to the point where not only the anti-Semitism has become so intolerable, especially right where I'm at in New York City and places like City College, NYU, but especially Columbia and Barnard affiliated with Columbia, that now the administration says I'm holding back funds. Whatever you think, Billions of dollars fly to these institutions. I'm not sure why. They say for research, to supplement people's colleges, whatever. They flow. The endowment grows because the most successful usually graduate from there and give back to there for influence, for their kids, for legacy, whatever. Well, the Trump administration says if you want your billions, Harvard, Columbia, Princeton, you better change a lot of things. Number one, merit-based hiring and admissions. How about that? Stop with the overweighted faculty. All liberal. Prioritize ideological diversity. Not just people that want to vote for Joe Biden and Barack Obama. Reform programs with records of anti-Semitism. Look into the curriculum. How hard is that? Discontinue DEI, not just in words, but in actions. No more masks on school students. Whistleblower reporting and protections. Transparency and monitoring when it comes to curriculum. Harvard said no. And we're suing back to get our money back. Really? You're going to sue to get grants? You're going to sue to get grants from federal dollars? Do you feel good about that? Not only is it impossible for your kids to get in because so many foreign students are taking up your spots, but you have to be a minority in order to get in. And that's got to end. That was ruled by the Supreme Court. Diversity admissions has to be a thing of the past. Affirmative action, rather. So now you have a situation where illegal immigrants or people on student visas that are acting in an anti-American, anti-Semitic way are going to be ousted. For example, Mohsen Mahdawi threatened and intimidated Jewish students, according to the State Department. This guy was at the hub along with Mahmoud Khalil of the anti-American, anti-Israel movement, the encampment movement that took over buildings at Columbia last year. He's going to be gone now. Here's Caroline Levitt, Cut 11.
Why do Ivy League schools get so much federal funding?
It's a very good question, and it's a question the president has obviously raised in his discussions and negotiations with not just Harvard, but also Columbia and many other Ivy League institutions. We have the anti-Semitism task force, which the president promised and delivered on. The anti-Semitism task force is across the government, representatives from various federal agencies who meet on a weekly basis to discuss the question that you just raised. And I think a lot of Americans are wondering why their tax dollars are going to these universities when they are not only indoctrinating our nation's students, but also allowing such egregious illegal behavior to occur.
Right. And that's going to stop. And I love this confrontation. Robert Hur, a conservative attorney, famously did the Hur Report, is representing Harvard. Columbia says we're not going to get involved in curriculum manipulation. You can't have a role in that, but they're doing the things they think are necessary to get their $400 million back. Princeton's also going to fight it. Good luck with that. I can't wait for the discovery phase where you go in and say, what kind of courses are you teaching? What are you doing with all that money? When you go to research something, how much money is going to the research? How much is going to overhead? How much are these salaries of these professors? Why is faculty overrunning with numbers? Who are the people that go to your schools? Why are you accepting outside money from other countries? Why are you not being transparent? I can't wait for that. When we come back, we find out what Generation Z is thinking about Republicans and Democrats and what they've thought about the first 4 months of Trump and what they think about the next 2 years when we get to the midterms. Don't move.
Diving deep into today's top stories, it's Brian Kilmeade. The fastest 3 hours in radio. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
All right. Now let's talk about what the next generation of Americans, Republicans, Democrats, are thinking 4 months into the Trump term. And looking at Joe Biden coming back, reminding us that the last 4 years was of his one and done term. And let's bring in Xavier DeRosso. Xavier is from PragerU, great personality, RNC Youth Advisory Council, former BLM activist. Xavier, welcome to the Brian Kilmeade Show. Thanks for being on.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
No problem. So your thoughts so far, 4 months in, thinking about Joe Biden's message yesterday as compared to what Trump is doing every day?
Well, I mean, I can only imagine how bitter Joe Biden is at this point to look back in retrospect at how terrible his 4 years were and how quickly people wanted to get him out. President Trump so far has done exactly what Gen Z has asked of him. He has taken action from the second he swore into office. You know, Gen Z, we want to see action. We are tired of being told that these things are going to happen and these things are going to be on the horizon. We like efficiency and effectivity. And so far, President Trump, every single day of his presidency, we feel like he is doing what he needs to do to push our country forward. And that's what we need.
How are you different now than you were, let's say, 10 years ago?
Whew. My entire mindset has completely shifted. You know, 10 years ago, I was already marching for BLM. I was a very active, progressive activist. I viewed everything through this lens of race just because of a number of factors in the very progressive left-wing household that I grew up in. But now I view everything from a sense of accountability. I don't view things through the lens of race anymore. And ultimately, I just like to see things through logic.
And for a long time is, like you saw African-Americans, like I've talked to Tim Scott. He always had to justify why he's a Republican. He finds himself doing it all the time. And other people that I know. Do you feel the same way? Or are we past that?
You know, I do feel like there is still quite a bit of people trying to understand why it is that so many Black people are moving over to the right or becoming conservative.
Especially and men.
What was that?
Especially men.
Especially men. But you know what? It makes sense when you really put it down on paper. You know, Black men, just like every other American, we deal with the exact same issues when it comes to the economy. We deal with employment. We deal with safety in our neighborhoods, wanting to protect our families, wanting to put food on the table. These are the issues that we actually care about. The left only wants to talk to Black men and young people about racism and social justice causes and all of these things that ultimately either don't really exist as issues or don't affect our day to day. You know, Black people, we want to be able to have serious discussions about how to move our country forward. And at a certain point, we realize that this invisible boogeyman of racism is not even in the top 100 issues that we're facing in America today.
Well, no one told Joe Biden yesterday he was getting reflective. Listen to this, cut 25.
Thank you, thank you, thank you.
As a United States Senator 400 years ago, and I'd never seen hardly any Black people in Scranton at the time when I was only going in fourth grade. And I remember seeing the kids going by at the time called colored kids on a bus going by.
I mean, is that necessary? I mean, that's what he always wants to hammer home. Remember Jim Crow 2.0, because they started to ask for ID when it comes to voting in Georgia. When that stuff is done to incite into anger.
You know, it's really insulting to the intelligence of Black people when we constantly hear this narrative about Jim Crow and slavery and all these different things that happened before majority of us were born. You know, we have moved on. We have moved on as a society. We have moved on as a country. And we want to talk about the issues today and tomorrow. Focusing on the past, it just makes it seem like they believe that Black people are stuck in that era too. And it really shows the way that someone like Joe Biden still views us. If he feels the need to constantly remind us that we were called colored and segregated, then it shows that he has not allowed his mindset regarding Black people to advance to where we are today. And it's truly a testament of why they lost.
The other thing, Xavier, that I hear too is the Democrats are frustrated with their own party. James Carville in particular, the guy that put Clinton in office, now considered a moderate, said this. He thinks it's time for a split. Cut 32.
I don't think we can work together on pronoun politics. This election did not teach you how damaging that is. They never run against a Republican. Okay. All they do is run against other Democrats. Don't quite understand why you're so anxious to have the word Democrat in the description of what you do, but maybe we can have a amicable split here. And you go your way, and we go our way, and after the election, we come together and see how much common ground we can find.
And I think that he's saying, give me Fetterman, maybe Bill Maher these days, Harold Ford these days, and you could keep your AOC, your Bernie Sanders, and your squad.
You know, I do predict that there's going to be a huge divide when it comes to the Democrat Party, because you have these people who have gone so progressive that it feels like there's no way to return. Then you have the more moderate Democrats that are realizing that all of these issues that they're dying on the hills of, they're losing issues. The common sense average American is not going to support all of the radical progressive ideas that people are pushing, the Marxism that's being pushed, the anti-American sentiments that's being pushed. And there's a reason why people turned out so largely for President Trump. I know a lot of people who voted Democrat their entire lives, but they were tired of seeing our country move backwards when they're claiming that they're progressing us forward, but really they're just crumbling our economy, they're dividing our country, and they're making us all miserable.
Yeah, I hear you, especially when you crack down on the border. People say, well, the issues divide us. Who is against securing our border? Why is that anti-American or anti-immigrant? Most people understand that just pro-American, we have to have control who's coming in and out. And for those people who say it's impossible, the president just showed it's not impossible. It just takes a will. Xavier Durso, thanks so much. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
All right, when we come back, Josh Hammer joins us. We go inside the quest to get rid of Hamas once and for all and take down Iran, or at least get rid of their nuclear program. Josh Hammer, senior editor of Newsweek, author of a new book, Israel and Civilization. Don't move.
The talk show that's getting you talking. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
So Josh Hammer is a senior editor-at-large in Newsweek, author of a new book, Israel and Civilization, The Fate of the Jewish Nation and the Destiny of the West. Josh, welcome. Congratulations on the book, and how timely.
Brian, great to join you. Yeah, we really could not have picked a more crucial time to release this book. I mean, Israel is one of those topics, Brian, as you know, that seemingly is often in the news, but it is rarely in the news as much as it is right now. Lots of conversations happening all across the political spectrum. So thank God the book has been very successful out of the gate. It actually reached a high of number 3 on all of Amazon.com the day that it came out. So its sales have been quite good. And, praise God for that, for sure.
Right. I mean, a couple of things going on. You say this is not just Israel's fight, and they've said that all along. There's little Satan, Israel, according to Iran, and there's big Satan, us. And that's pretty much the way a lot of the world looks at the West. And that's what made this so what's happening on college campuses so disturbing. It's like we're being hollowed out from within.
You know, Brian, a story that I recount in the book that I like to tell. I was speaking last summer in Washington, D.C. for YAF, Young America's Foundation. I was speaking about U.S.-Israel relations, the Middle East there. And I was kind of giving my standard speech on this. And I noticed someone standing in the back of the room in the rafters, I guess you would call it the nosebleed section, just vigorously nodding along, like unusually so. And I kind of made a mental note to myself, and I said, I'm going to try to find that guy after my talk and see what he's nodding along about. Sure enough, after the talk, he finds me. He rushes up to talk to me. Turns out this guy grew up in Tehran. He spent the first 16 years of his life in Tehran before his family fled to come to the United States. And he told me that growing up in Iranian state schools as he did there, their version of what we in the United States have as our Pledge of Allegiance, I pledge allegiance to the flag, their version in Iranian schools is they make all their students solemnly vow to do all that they can that day to bring death and destruction to the little Satan of Israel and the big Satan of America. They literally do that to their pupils every single day in their schools. And it's not just an empty, hollow threat, Brian. As you know, this evil regime actually acts on this impulse. We saw this with the hundreds of Americans tragically murdered in the roadside IEDs during the Iraq War. We've seen it repeatedly when it comes to Iranian proxies such as Hezbollah and Hamas, many of whom, along with the Houthis, have immense American blood on their hands. We saw tragically at Tower 22, the military base in the far-flung corner of Jordan last January there. So these forces that Israel is fighting against, they really are fighting them not just on behalf of the Jewish state. They really are fighting it on behalf of Western civilization. That, in many ways, is the core argument of my book.
Right. And then you have Iran, for people who think they're going to be compliant because they've been hit so hard. They basically called for the destruction of Israel again yesterday. That's the Ayatollah.
Time and time again, they do this. They genuinely believe this. This is the key thing to understand, especially as we sit down with negotiations with them right now to see whether or not we can get some sort of diplomatic off-ramp. you have to understand, you're not dealing here with cold, calculating, rational actors. You're dealing with a fundamentalist Islamist regime that genuinely, truly believes in the death and destruction of all infidels. And they define the term infidel, as most radical jihadis do, quite broadly, where it includes all Jews, all Christians, frankly, also most Muslims as well, who don't necessarily adhere to their idiosyncratic interpretation of Islam. But again, they've shown through word and deed that they actually act on this impulse. And just to give you another example, Brian, another anecdote that I share in the book, when I do these talks to younger audiences, I oftentimes get asked, you know, what does America gain from the U.S.-Israel relationship? And I'll give you just one example. So last summer, when Israel was going on this extended killing spree, ultimately culminating in Hassan Nasrallah, the head Hezbollah jihadi in Beirut, Lebanon, and then Yahya Sinwar, the head Hamas guy in Rafah, Gaza. Before that, they took out two Hezbollah commanders by the names of Fuad Shakur and Ibrahim Akil. So who are Fuad Shakur and Ibrahim Akil? Well, they are the two men responsible, respectively, for the 1983 Beirut, Lebanon Marine barracks bombing that killed 241 U.S. Marines. And then Akil was the mastermind of the Beirut embassy bombing that killed 60 to 70 Americans that same year. They had U.S. State Department bounties on their heads of $5 and $7 million. Nothing happened until the IDF just took them out last year. So that's really, I think, a pretty illustrative example, I think.
I think so, too. They were able to really go a long way to destroying Hezbollah. And now with the new president, they're allowed to maybe finish the job with Hamas. You know, for those people, the Palestinians, they're having trouble getting aid in because all the aid we were giving was going to the terrorist organization. What do you think is going to happen with Hamas at the same time keeping an eye on the Houthi rebels long range and Tehran, who's maybe a couple of weeks away from a nuclear weapon?
Well, a couple of things. So focusing just for a second on Gaza specifically. So Israel has no choice but to genuinely, on its own terms, finish the job in Gaza. And they have no choice for at least two reasons. First and foremost, because they announced it as their military goal. And in a region, the Arab world, the Middle East, where the lingua franca is power, you simply cannot then fail to live up to your military goal once you very clearly enunciate it, as Israel did. The second related point is that you have a president of the United States, Donald Trump, who instinctually respects strength and abhors and detests weakness. So if he sees you as a nominal ally fail to finish the job, he's actually going to lose respect for you. Donald Trump, in many ways, has basically been begging Netanyahu to do exactly that, this fiery rhetoric of there will be all hell to pay there. I feel like he's essentially basically just implicitly begging Netanyahu, just do this. Just finish the job. I will have your back there. So Bibi and Israel, they're really going to have to finish the job in Gaza. But getting to the Iran component, that really is the obvious elephant in the room. I mean, the Israelis like to refer to Iran as the head of the snake. They are the orchestrators of essentially all or at least the vast, vast majority of the evil that is currently afflicting the Middle East at this time. Israel's been in a seven-front war when you look at it for the past year and a half or so. All seven of those fronts ultimately wind their way back to the tentacles of the Islamist regime in Tehran. At some point, that regime is going to have to go. And I'm not calling for America to necessarily do it for them. But I happen to take the same stance that Donald Trump took the first time around, the maximum pressure campaign, when he was working with Mike Pompeo there, crippling financial sanctions. They are really turning the screws on the Ayatollah and the mullahs there. And they were really, really hurting, Brian. They were on the precipice of outright economic calamity there. And to me, that's the best policy. You ultimately try to do that. You try to support clandestinely under the radar the Iranian people, most of whom abhor this terrible jihadist leadership in Tehran there. Ultimately, that regime's going to have to go one way or the other there, because they really are at the root of the evil across the region.
And I want you to hear what this is, people to understand. Eric, remember yesterday we had that President Clinton clip. So for people who are just getting involved, like Josh, you live this thing, you know the history. That's why you wrote the book, Israel and Civilization, The Fate of the Jewish Nation, The Destiny of the West. But when people talk about the peace initiative, you know, they go back and they remember what Jimmy Carter did. But people should know that there was a huge effort to get Yasser Arafat, representing the Palestinian organization, to agree to a homeland, which would have been Gaza, a bridge to the West Bank, and parts of Jerusalem. So when people talk about, you know, what Israel's doing and the impatience and we should just give them an opportunity to live the life that they live, this is what Bill Clinton remembers.
And the only time Yasser Arafat didn't tell me the truth was when he promised me he was going to accept the peace deal that we had worked out, which would have given the Palestinians a state on 96% of the West Bank and 4% of Israel, and they got to choose where the 4% of Israel was. So they would have the effect of the same land of all the West Bank. They would have a capital in East Jerusalem. They would have, I can hardly talk about this, and they would have equal access all day, every day, to the security towers that Israel maintained all through the West Bank up to the Golan Heights. All this was offered, including, I will say it again, a capital in East Jerusalem and two of the four quadrants of the old city of Jerusalem, confirmed by the Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak and his cabinet. And they said no. And I think part of it is that Hamas did not care about a homeland for the Palestinians. They wanted to kill Israelis and make Israel uninhabitable.
Congratulations, Mr. President. Back in the 90s, you were 100% right. Am I right, Josh?
Yeah, I mean, I don't oftentimes credit Bill Clinton, but he was so broad there in the clip that we just heard when it comes to Yasser Arafat. You know, I believe it was the old Israeli government minister and public intellectual man by the name of Abba Ibn who famously said that the Palestinians never missed an opportunity to miss an opportunity. And so it has been. They have rejected at least four or five so-called two-state solution offers. By the way, going back to literally before the State of Israel was formed. So the State of Israel was formed in May of 1948. President Harry Truman becomes the first president to recognize it internationally approximately 11 minutes later. Prior to that, in November of 1947, the United Nations proposed a so-called two-state solution. It was actually a tiny, tiny, tiny sliver of a Jewish state. It didn't even make sense geographically, but the Jews were so desperate, they immediately said yes. The Arabs said no. And the rest, tragically, is history. But they've been given so many opportunities here, and they just simply do not want peace. They ultimately just want dead Jews, dead infidels, dead Westerners, as they show just time and time again. But another key point, Brian, related to that, is I have a whole chapter in the book making the foreign policy realist. I call it the America First case for U.S.-Israel relations there. And Donald Trump, I think to his great credit, completely understands this. He acted this out during his first term with the whole Abraham Accords peace process. He's doing it again thus far today because he views foreign policy soberly, as I think someone ought to do, not through a Pollyanna-ish rose-colored glasses tint. And he sees that an emboldened Israel is simply in the American national interest. And the natural corollary to that, Brian, is that chopping Israel in half and giving it to an Iranian proxy, these bloodthirsty jihadists, whether they're in Gaza or Ramallah, that's simply not in the American national interest. It's just not. You maybe can make a different kind of argument to try to get a so-called two-state solution and chop Israel in half. But if you're looking at this through a sober U.S. national interest foreign policy paradigm, it's a total, total non-starter.
The IDF, by the way, and ISA have eliminated the senior aide of Hamas's Gaza Brigade commander. A few days ago, they had this operation to take him out. They're continuing to get rid of these guys full bore. It wasn't happening under Joe Biden. He kept on saying, you better not go forward, you better get aid in, condemning them and fueling a lot of the anti-Semitism raging on college campuses now, too. So which brings me to what's happening now with these colleges. They are focusing and going full bore to rid this campus of ungrateful, insurrectionist students, oftentimes on full rides, who are causing havoc in places like Columbia. Mahmoud Khalil, you write, is not an American citizen. Neither is some of his comrades, including this guy, Moshan Madawi. He was from the West Bank. He heads up the Palestinian Columbia University Student Council. And he was causing a lot of the unrest to take over buildings. He's gone. How important is it to get these expulsions moving forward?
Oh, it's tremendously important. You know, Brian, there's so much or disinformation, I should say, when it comes to this issue of these non-citizens on campuses and elsewhere, that a lot of it appears to me to be coming from a deeply disingenuous and, frankly, just dishonest place. So legally speaking, constitutional law, when it comes to something like due process, we have always drawn a very hard distinction between citizen and non-citizen. If you are not a citizen, you do not have a due process right to remain in this country. There's a famous case from 1953 called Shaughnessy. Justice Robert Jackson, who just 9 years prior to that in the Japanese internment case called Korematsu, he dissented because he took a very strong due process stand. So he was known as a champion of due process. Nonetheless, in 1953, he famously wrote in this case, Shaughnessy, that due process does not entail the rights of any person around the world to come to the United States. It similarly does not entail any alien who is here, whether legally or illegally, the right to remain here against the national will. So if you are not a citizen, and this, again, this is whether you're legal or illegal, you do not have a Fifth, 14th Amendment due process right to remain here against the national will. So you essentially can be deported at any time for any reason. Now, it also happens to be the fact that the Immigration Nationality Act, the 1952 statute, does say that a removal can be initiated if it would serve the foreign policy interests of the United States to do so. That's the argument that Secretary of State Rubio and others have been making there, yep. Is that getting rid of people like Mahmoud Khalil, like this so-called Maryland man, the MS-13 guy, that all this serves America's national security and foreign policy interests. That all of this is extraordinarily important stuff. It is frankly long overdue. It says a lot about the state of the modern left, by the way, that they are going.
Yes,
out
they're going
on
to bat for
limb.
Them. They were silent when they were causing havoc, and they're going to bat for them now that they're being pressed to find out their real agenda while tracking illegal immigrants over to El Salvador to make sure they're healthy. So it's just crazy what's going on. Josh, congratulations on the success of your book. Pick it up, Israel and Civilization, The Fate of the Jewish Nation and the Destiny of the West. And we'll read all your stuff in Newsweek. Thanks so much, Josh.
Thanks so much, Brian. Appreciate it.
Back in a moment.
You're with Brian Kilmeade. He's so busy, he'll make your head spin. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Obviously, the irony is perfectly crushing. This is a person who prosecuted Trump for everything short of ripping a label off a mattress. And among the charges that were brought in New York in not just the civil but the criminal case was making false or misleading statements to financial institutions. And one of these sections, Section 1014 of the federal code, is prosecuted. It took me about 60 seconds of a search to find cases that the Department of Justice brought against people who falsely claimed that property was their principal residence in order to get loans. As for James, if we apply the Letitia James standard that she created, there'd be little question here. This seems pretty straightforward. What the administration is saying is this was not her principal residence. In fact, as a New York elected official, she had to say that her principal residence was in New York.
So that is Jonathan Turley breaking down on the breaking news last night that was broke on the Laura Ingraham show that Letitia James was sent a letter from the Department of Justice. Basically, it's a criminal referral. Why? Because she did these things on real estate where it wasn't accurate. For example, she listed as her dad as co-signer. Well, it's interesting, being an adult, have a dad co-signer. And then said he was her spouse in 1983 to buy a house and in 2000. Also, the Federal Housing Finance Agency found out that she listed Virginia as her primary residence. That's kind of interesting because she's the Attorney General for New York. That doesn't seem accurate, does it? She also has a five-unit building that she owns. Don't know how she got that, but whatever. She listed it as four-unit building. That's a little different. That affects his taxes. So that also affects basically how much money you have. She also wants to investigate at the same time Donald Trump to have insider trading. Good luck with that. Now she's got a lawyer up. She can kick her shoes off if she wants, like she did during the Trump trial. And kick back and wonder, is she going to be prosecuted? And guess who's going to be on Trump's side? Everybody with the name Cuomo. They hate her. De Blasio hates Cuomo. There's a lot of animus towards her. Well, now you can feel the heat.
From Ohio atop Fox News headquarters in New York City. Always seeking solutions, never sowing division. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the latest moments of the show. I come to you from 48th and 6th in Midtown Manhattan, where our attorney general finds herself in legal trouble, lying on mortgage applications, pretending her dad is her spouse. I'm talking about Letitia James, nemesis of our current president, who decides that even though the president paid everybody back, that he wasn't thoroughly truthful on the mortgage applications for financing for his buildings. So she sued him. Cost him $450 million. Remember, they were trying to take his stuff, and she was going to go to Trump Tower and sell it off. And no, he got a bond, and now they're appealing, and now they're going after her. I got details on that. Liz Claman will break down the latest on the trade wars and the tariff trauma. But let's and that's from FBN. But let's get to the big three.
Number three.
And I'd never seen hardly any black people in Scranton at the time when I was only going in fourth grade. And I remember seeing the kids going by at the time called colored kids on a bus going by.
Is that what they call them, colored kids on a bus going by? It's so great to hear from the President of the United States. He's incoherent as ever. Is this the messenger the Dems have to get them out of the doldrums, really? Who aren't even speaking to each other, by the way? The Clintons, the Obamas, the Bidens. Trump and Musk are the enemy. Why not make stuff up about them, like they're going to cut Social Security? Hasn't that ship sailed? We'll discuss it.
Number two.
There is a chance that the money from tariffs could be so great that it would replace, you know, in the old days, about 1870 to 1913, the tariffs were the only form of money.
Tariff drama continues, and a new game plan emerges for Trump to cut better deals with our allies and other world members, but also make them isolate China as part of the agreement. Meanwhile, China all over us, they're cutting off materials for batteries and bombs and our pharmaceuticals expected later today. This is superpower versus superpower.
Number one.
I don't even know if we announced this, but I am planning tomorrow to go to El Salvador to work to bring him home. The Trump administration themselves, that he was wrongfully abducted from the United States.
Do you believe this? That's Martin O'Malley. That is Senator Van Hollen, I should say. Here we go. Crackdown on colleges and illegals. Has the Trump administration in a standoff with the Ivies and with the illegals as Dems astoundingly, as you just heard, go to bat for illegal gang members, not for American citizens. I don't want to go into it in that detail, but Kilmer Albergo Garcia was in Virginia. He came here at 16. At 20 years old, he got arrested by the Prince County officers, police force. They realized he was here illegally, brought here by his parents at the time. They have suspicion of being a member of the MS-13 gang, as brutal and vicious as anybody in our country, including our own gangs. So he got handed over to ICE with a notice to appear. And that was 2019. He got a notice to appear, at which time the judge says, no, you got to get out of here. We think you're a member of MS-13. So he came back for a dispatch notice. And in April. So in December, he comes back, at which time the judge says, you're a member of MS-13, I believe, and we got to kick you out of the country. He said, no, I want to apply for asylum. And just in case you don't give me asylum, whatever you do, don't throw me back to El Salvador. My safety will be in jeopardy. So a judge says, okay, you have a motion. We have a motion to toss you out of the country, a removal proceedings. But that was a couple of years ago. Under the Biden administration, nobody was going anywhere. So this guy thought he was safe. Well, Trump comes in, gets a list of MS-13 people, Tom Homan did, says, you're out of here. But they go, wait a second, he's in El Salvador. You said there's a provision here not to kick him to El Salvador. Well, okay. But the provision was there because MS-13 was dominating El Salvador, and right now they're all in jail. So his security is not in jeopardy. In fact, he's with his brethren, the gangsters. Well, they said you got to go through the courts to do that. And it's going back and forth now. And then a judge says you got to go try to get him out. And then we asked the president of El Salvador, he doesn't want to get him out. And they said you got to try harder to get him out. So this kind of craziness is going on. Then you have Senator Chris Van Hollen say this, cut two.
He believes that we are now in a constitutional crisis. What say you?
Oh, I believe we are. And it's gotten much worse even the last 24 hours because of this outright defiance of the Supreme Court, the outright defiance of a district court judge, and there will be a hearing on this case tomorrow, but she was backed up by 9-0 from the Supreme Court. So two things have to happen. Number one, the courts do need to hold the Trump Justice Department in contempt, and the courts have the power to issue sanctions.
So he's now going to El Salvador to go check out the prison. No proof he's going to see it with anybody, but he's making a stand there. Meanwhile, Rachel Morin was killed in his very state, and his killer was found and convicted of murder, the illegal immigrant killer. Do you know that Tom Homan told us this morning that the state of Maryland was no help? It took weeks to find this guy because we had no help from the cops because they're not allowed because it's a sanctuary state. And meanwhile, this guy's going to check on his MS-13 buddy. He mistakenly calls him a constituent, and he's concerned about El Salvador. Well, Maryland's falling apart, awash in debt, and they got a bridge to rebuild. We know all about that. So here's Donald Trump talking to Rachel about this. Cut 9.
I call them homegrown criminals.
Yes.
I mean, the homegrowns.
The ones
that grew up and something went wrong, and they hit people over the head with a baseball bat. And push people into subways just before the train gets there, like you see happening sometimes. We are looking into it, and we want to do it. I would love to do that.
So he just said, look, we're going to send other people to El Salvador with this guy, and we'll see where that goes. So the other thing we're talking about is tariffs. And today we found out that we're raising the tariffs on China, and they've come back and said to us, you know, we told you the other day we're holding back your rare earth materials, your metals, and your magnets. Well, now we're going to start considering holding back pharmaceuticals. Pretty devastating. They have a lot of our generic drugs. So some say, well, we moved a lot to India. Well, India was getting a lot of them from China. So it's bad for us, no doubt about it. And in 2020, we had emergency movement to start getting our pharmaceuticals out of there because of the pandemic. They caused it, and they were holding back our gloves, our masks, our syringes, our blood thinners, our antibiotics. So we had to make an emergency move to start hoarding our own. And guess who stopped it? It was called the Strategic Active Pharmaceutical Ingredients Reserve. It was stopped and filled up because Joe Biden just lost interest in it. No problem. Pandemic's over. Let's continue to have oral pharmaceuticals made overseas. Absolutely crazy. The other place it's made is Ireland. I guess we still have decent relations with Ireland, even though they're pro-Palestinian. A little disappointed with my brethren over there. So now the U.S. plans to use tariff negotiations to isolate China. The administration plans to use ongoing negotiations to pressure U.S. trading partners. And I hear this morning Japan is going to come aboard first major partner to announce a restructuring of our partnership for reductions in trade and tariff barriers imposed by the White House. So they're looking for us to form a team against China and make everybody know. Also, Canada is starting to sober up. They drop retaliatory tariffs on automakers and pauses others to give relief to Canadian businesses. The Minister of Finance says we'll back off for now. So they woke up. So things are settling down, even though the market's down a few hundred points right now. But this thing is amping up. And this is what Trump's always said. Trump's always said China is our problem. They cheat. There's no balance. They have way too much of our vital goods. And it's got to change. And it's got to be an emergency. And I think the president would do well to explain it to all of us. So how is Trump doing party to party? I think pretty well. I mean, he's still just under 50%, but I don't expect anything different. He could be playing the perfect game. He's got all the media working against you. But one thing he's trying to do is everything he promised, even if it gets on people's nerves, even if there's more judges trying to stop him than any in history. But people also talk about the people that got behind him. And the fact is that Trump has not shut you off. He has not shut you down. You were there to get him elected. You got access. Do you have an expertise? I'm going to need you. So there's a venture capitalist called Chalamath Palatithia, and he donated money to both parties. And he says, this is the difference I find with the Trump administration. Cut 35.
This is one thing I'll tell you about the Trump administration, which is totally different. Okay, I was a lifelong Democrat, okay? I was a mega donor to the Democrats. You know, like dinner with Obama level donor, okay? I couldn't get phone call return from the White House to save my life. So anyways, the Trump administration is totally different. There's not a single person there you can't get on the phone and talk to.
Look, when you give money, you want to have some influence. It doesn't seem you got to dominate. You tell me Elon Musk, with all the money he gave, he didn't get Howard Lutnick to be the Treasury Secretary. That wasn't his pick. You know, he's fighting with Peter Navarro left and right. I think he was very happy that Altman and the Oracle founder were putting together the $500 billion power station. But he's still tight with Trump. He doesn't get everything, but he's got influence. No question about it. Now, that's a good thing, you would think. So if you want to get a hold of someone on the Trump team, even if they want to get mad at you, they can get you and you can get a hold of them. That was spun differently on a place called, I think you pronounce it CNN, Cut 36. Alex Gibney, director of HBO, documentary called Dark Money Game.
I would say two things about that. One is it's a little terrifying that it's so easy to get people on the phone that they're not really so busy doing their jobs. And number two, I think that expectation is precisely the problem. The idea, like, I'm given the money, you better service me. That's the terrifying part. I think the expectation that for an amount of money, you get something back. That's not the way it's really supposed to work in elections, where a few people, because they have a lot of money, get their needs served and the rest of us go wanting.
I mean, could you ever heard such ridiculous spin? Because you're accessible and open and not arrogant, that's scary to you? He didn't say, you know, I call up the Trump team and I tell them to lower these tariffs and do me a favor, make sure that such and such stadium gets all the signage that they need, and let's make sure that such and such gets invited to this party. And my best buddy needs to be the ambassador to Italy. He's saying I can get somebody on the phone and I can talk to him. Like, for example, these tariffs, you want to know about what's going on in input, about how it affects your individual industry, get somebody on the phone. Because it's a relatively flat organization, for better or for worse. And when they get mad at you, you get a call. Or then they also help you out when you got a big interview coming up and they say, this is our point of view. And I like it. I really do. So we'll talk about that and I'll keep you up to date on what's happening with these tariffs, because we know that Gavin Newsom is now announcing a lawsuit against the Trump administration about having these tariffs that impact, he says, the California economy. So if you're Gavin Newsom, could you be a bigger idiot? Because if you don't care about your own persona and profile, and at the same time you're asking the administration to bail you out because you didn't have a fire department to put out fires that burned your top city to the ground, you want the federal government to help you out, and you do that? You think that Trump is going to sit there, not forget that, not remember that? So the other thing I want to talk about is what Joe Biden said yesterday. I don't want to play any cuts for me. It aggravates me too much. But he just stumbled his way through a speech. He is totally not acknowledging or not cognizant of the books that have been written that talked about how he was not even in charge when he was in charge, how he basically only worked an hour a day, how his staff was so embarrassed by him, they wouldn't even let him interact with other people, which means his family signed off on it. So I'm not going to bore you with his horrible speech. Just know this. He said 30% of the country are horrible people. That's what he said MAGA is, 30% of the country. Really? They got just about 50% of the vote. Popular vote and more states, 30-20. Every battleground state. So he insults MAGA and he insults all Republicans. Okay, good. And then you've got to wonder, who's speaking for the Democratic Party? Is it AOC? Is it Bernie Sanders? Are they happy that Joe Biden's speaking? Here's Rahm Emanuel, who was a bad mayor of Chicago, but a very smart guy, who just comes off an ambassador to Japan under Joe Biden. Cut 29.
President Biden's voice is important, but understanding the strategic landscape we're in, President Trump is using that as his kind of backboard. And that's not helpful, not only for the country, most importantly, but also the Democrats who want to talk about and go into the future and make this a referendum on Donald Trump and his tenure.
Okay. If you look, if you want to have an indictment of Joe Biden, why he should be embarrassed to show his face, look what they did in the border. The numbers in the border are stunning. It just shows you if you have a will, you have a strategy, competent people, what you can get done. I never thought it was even possible. If you want to crack down on anti-Semitism in our country, you could do it by identifying the insurrectionists on these campuses, finding out what they do, and you make sure that these people are accountable. But when you talk about what's happening at the border, listen to this. In March of 2024, 137,473 people crossed the border. In March of 2025, the number is 7,181. And I would venture a guess that they all got turned around. And I also say this. This is not counting these people that hopped on that app and oftentimes got a plane ride into our country, didn't have to cross the border. But right now, the president's improved the border crossings 95%. And perhaps more vital is the fentanyl. In 2024, there was 760 pounds. 2025, there was 760 pounds of fentanyl, up 24% from February, up 47% of all drugs combined versus February. So they were able to get more, to seize more drugs, 50% more drugs than Joe Biden did a year ago. The Del Rio sector under Trump versus Biden, it's virtually empty. Now they're building a wall at the same time, concertina wire on top and in the middle. So you want to throw a blanket over it, you're not going to get over it. I don't care how big your ladder is. It's outrageous. I'll take a short time out and come back and take your calls, 1-866-408-7669. Liz Claman will unwind what's happening with the economy right now, which is down just 87 points, but we're still over 40,000. Don't move.
Want even more, Brian? Download the podcast at BrianKilmeadShow.com. Every episode, exclusive interviews on demand. More of Kilmeade coming up. Information you want, truth you demand. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Today, the Department of Justice is announcing a civil lawsuit against the Maine Department of Education. The state of Maine is discriminating against women by failing to protect women in women's sports. Pretty basic stuff. This is a violation of Title IX. The Department of Justice will not sit by when women are discriminated against in sports. This is about sports. This is also about these young women's personal safety.
And that is Pam Bondi a few hours ago announcing a lawsuit because the federal government wasn't allowed to cut off funds to Maine when they wouldn't adhere to Title IX and allow women to compete against women in sports and allow trans men to dominate their sports. So Maine won't comply. Unlike the other states, they decided to sue. So good luck with that. You're all wasting money because you won't do the right thing. This is a 90-10 issue, 95-5 issue. And still, if anyone has a daughter, if anyone has a sister, anyone has a mother competing or has competed in sports, you think it's fair to have somebody who going through gender dysphoria run them over as they go for a loose ball or a loose puck or anything, whether it's field hockey or soccer or getting spiked in the head in volleyball? It's just absolutely insane. John, you're listening on the Fox News app in California. Hey, John.
Good morning, Brian. Love the show today.
Hey, we're going to be talking business in a second. What's your worry?
I don't worry. Every day I wake up, I'm happy. Okay. There's something new going on with this administration that makes me and puts a smile on my face. Now, the biggest worry I was having was the financial markets. I think people need to realize in 2019, interest on the debt, because of interest rates and the amount of debt, was about $380 billion. Today, it's $900 billion. What do you think would happen to financial markets if we weren't able to pay the debt?
Oh, I hear you. That's a great point. And not only that, interest rates go up, the debt goes up, too. Thanks so much. Liz Claman next.
From his mouth to your ears, it's Brian Kilmeade.
Hey, we are back. With me right now is Liz Claman, anchor of the Claman Countdown at 3 o'clock today. She came in early just for us because of these consequential times. Liz, great to see you.
Thank you so much for schlepping me in here.
Absolutely. No, yes, we provided transportation. I hope. At least I'll reimburse you if you did take an Uber.
From the 20th floor to the 15th.
Do you feel better this week than last week?
Actually, slightly less frazzled, although it is a constant flow of changing headlines. So just to give you an idea, I anchor the final hour of trade, 3 p.m. Eastern. And obviously it's not how the market opens, it's how the market closes that really matters. We cannot write the top of the show until literally minutes before because everything is constantly changing. And I write the top of the show. And I go through everything. Like, here's why the markets are moving the way they are. And I have found that starting over the past 3 weeks, especially after April 2nd, when the president announced the deliberation day tariffs, that I have been constantly cutting and pasting. And then I said, forget it. I'm just going to wait till the last second to write it.
Well, the thing is, it's hard for us to disseminate. We have to react. Do you think the president's in organizing the way he's doing that? Do you think he had the ultimate? Does he have a good plan?
I'd love to know that plan, because the plan looks like it's constantly shape-shifting in front of us. I would believe that the president, and if you listen to the narrative from the White House, Brian, I would believe that they say this is a master class in negotiation, but the way it's being implemented looks like Wreck-It Ralph.
True. And it seems now, I think the new mission is, let's cut some deals with our allies, other nations, and let's make part of that deal that you start to isolate China. So they're not backing off, and China isn't either. We woke up to this weekend finding out that they're going to cut down on metals, to magnets.
Yeah.
It's going to affect our bombs and our computers.
Let me just tell you that yesterday I had the CEO of Rivian. Rivian is the EV company that has a zeitgeist at the moment. People love those vertical headlamps, and you see a lot of them more and more on the streets.
Electric?
They are made in the town called Normal in Illinois. Okay, so they're made in America. Their engines, the big pieces, are made in America. So I said, my gosh, the Trump administration should be high-fiving you guys. This is precisely what he wants. He wants building in America, not assembling. However, I asked him about these new metals and elements tariffs that the Chinese are implementing. He had a look in his eye of, now it's getting real. Every single car engine, not just EVs, Brian, internal combustion, and I confirmed this with Bob Nardelli, who used to run Chrysler, every single one of them uses those magnets, and they are, you know, they're basically made in China. Every single one of them.
Do we have an alternate source to go anywhere, whether it's the Congo or smaller nations? We hear about Ukraine and rare earth.
We can mine it elsewhere. China is the one that refines it, quite frankly, because they don't care about their environment, and it is a very dirty process.
So right now, we understand, too, the thing that changed today, you just sent this over to me. So we're upping the tariff rate on China instead of backing off. And there's no sense that either side is going to talk, right?
Well, so this is interesting, because overnight China said, we would consider negotiating if you show us some respect. You know, the Chinese love to save face. I mean, which nation doesn't? But they are particular about it. And
especially this guy lives on being a tough guy. That's how he keeps his population
in. Of course. Well, you know, autocracy. Dictator. I mean, this is how it goes. What she says goes. However, that was a tiny window opening. And then this hit, where our reporter in D.C., Edward Lawrence, said that the Section 301 tariffs have now been announced on China. These tariffs are now raised to a rate on most items. This is in addition to everything that's already slapped on them, 7.5% to 100%, depending on the product. So they're product specific. What does that mean for EVs and things like syringes? The tariff rate, which was already at 145%, Brian, will now go to 245%.
So what are we going to do for pharmaceuticals if they decide to hold things back like they did with PPE during the pandemic?
Honestly, if I were one of the people who has to inject insulin or inject anything on my own, I would be rushing to CVS right now and stocking up on syringes, because we don't make anywhere near the capacity of what we need for syringes. I you know, I haven't had a minute because this just kind of
is developing. What about the insulin itself?
The insulin is another story. Yeah. Exactly.
So I want you, Larry, you did a fantastic interview with Larry Fink. Did you blow off your commercials and just roll?
We did.
You can
but
tell.
We did take one
you
break.
Have power,
we did take one break because we got to make money, right? I mean, obviously. But we blew out breaks.
And you can't be broad enough. You don't want to tell the, and you're the master at it. These are the experts. So what do you see rather than let me pigeonhole you into an answer? So you asked him about, you know, where we're going with these tariffs. Where do you see it? This was Friday?
Yeah.
Cut 45.
Until we have greater certainty from our administration as to where are we taking our tariff policy, when is the administration who spoke about how we are going to rebuild America through unlocking private capital, how we are going to reduce permitting process, how are we going to deregulate more? If we could unlock all the regulation and deregulate more so we have more flexibility to invest, these are the mega trends that can really lift back up the equity markets and our economy. In the short run, as we are focusing on issues like tariffs, and tariffs are a tax, they raise prices on the consumer.
Right. And that's what people say, but if the way Trump's using them, it could be to reconfigure trade relationships with as many as 70, 80 countries.
The end goal is very noble, 1,000%.
But in between?
But this process, I'm not sure it was truly thought out, unless there's something we don't know. But on Friday night, you saw that the U.S. Customs and Border, they filed some new paperwork that said that suddenly you didn't have tariffs on smartphones. That really helped Apple.
He relieved them. He said they were going to.
Yeah, he did. But then on Sunday, and what Larry's talking about is clarity, you had Howard Lutnick, the Commerce Secretary, come out and say, nope, nope, separate tariffs are about to be slapped on smartphones and other electronics, including autos and pharma, quote, in about a month or two. And then suddenly the president said yesterday, or somebody in the administration said yesterday, we are going to do an investigation on pharma and we'll get back to you in 6 months. Which is it?
Right. That's a problem, too. There's a lack of coordination. Mm-hmm. And the way I understand it in your business, Liz, that people want to hear from Scott Bessent, the Treasury Secretary, more than anybody else.
One voice. One voice.
But it's a sober voice. It's a sane voice.
And let's,
I worry
yeah,
about
exactly.
Peter Navarro. I have no interest in what he has to say. He's a theorist, professor. Trump likes him, and that's fine. But I have no interest in letting him lead us, lead our economy.
I know a toy maker, Isaac Larian, out in California, MGA Entertainment. They make Bratz dolls. They own Little Tykes, which they make in Hudson, Ohio. He is about to lay off people. He was on the front page of the New York Post yesterday saying, Mr. President, save my company.
Because all our toys are made in China.
Yes, and there were no tariffs on incoming toys because you don't want to be the guy slapping tariffs on children a few months before Christmas, or at least when people start to buy toys for Christmas. And I've heard from more people, but Isaac, I've been speaking to him. He is livid. Mm. He is a Trump supporter. He voted for the president. But then he started sending me pictures of his MAGA hat with a tag that said made in China. And he said, what is going on here? And he's trying to keep his company afloat. But he is now going to be slapped with something like $2 million a day in tariffs.
Do they have a choice? For example, I'm not in the toy business, but if I every day was getting my products from China, knowing that Trump was going to win re-election, he's going to go back and try to fix this. Mm-hmm. The tariffs were left on from Joe Biden. So obviously, Democrats and Republicans agreed for the most part on one thing. China was the issue. They steal our IP. They can't be trusted. They're not dealing from above board. Mm-hmm. Their labor costs, especially when it comes to the Uyghurs, even though our labor costs have gone up to the point where they're actually, I guess, subletting a lot of their stuff. They're sending it out. So I would think that a guy like that with that type of success would know, what if we get into a trade war with China? What do I do? It doesn't seem like he had a plan B, or is there just no plan B that exists?
I don't think that there is a plan B. It's kind of happening while the plane is in the air. They're riveting on the wings. And that's okay. Maybe that destabilizes our, you know, rivals in trade like China. But in the end, you're talking about business leaders who absolutely need they do 5-year outlooks. They can't do that right now. They simply cannot.
Right. Hold on tight. We'll see what happens. If
Indeed.
You start, let me, Liz, here's a scenario which I think could be likely, unless it's too complicated. We're going to go, you're going to walk into work and it's going to go deal with Japan, deal with Israel. Got a new deal with Vietnam. Got another deal with the Philippines. Big and small countries.
Let me jump in.
And then
China just struck a deal with Vietnam and Cambodia and Malaysia. She went over there and said, let's all work together. He is doing an end run.
But did he get a deal or did he have conversations?
I think he signed something with Vietnam. I mean, they put out
a
statement.
Them? They don't trust it. They're harassing Vietnamese ships right now in the South China Sea.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, watch out for Japan because Japan really hates China.
Right.
I mean, Japan.
And vice versa.
Exactly.
So I want you to hear what Kevin O'Leary said, which I think you can relate to.
Okay.
I'm pretty frustrated as an investor because the classic situation for small business and entrepreneurial investing is you find a product or service in America, you prove it in the American market to a run rate of $5 million a year on Amazon, and bang, it's ripped off in China. There's nothing you can do. You can't go appeal to WTO. It's deaf ears there. You can't litigate because we don't have access to their courts, even though they have access to ours. Not only that, they have access to our capital markets. We let them list companies here. So I have to compete with a Chinese company that is not compliant with GAAP, that completely ignore the regulator, raise money when I have to compete on a basis where I have to be compliant, spend millions of dollars in compliance, and make sure that the SEC and all the other regulatory bodies are okay with my issuance, but not the Chinese.
So did anything he say sound unique to Kevin O'Leary?
No. No, it is completely unfair.
He said everything that was correct, right?
Yeah, everything. And I talked to the IMAX CEO, Rich Gelfond. You know, back in the day, he was one of the first to go to China and strike up big partnerships to put those large screen IMAX screens in China. He now has something like 800 theaters there. Well, what did they do? And this was classic China. They went in the middle of the night. They looked at how the projection worked. They looked how the screens were made. They ripped it off. And they started opening their own theaters. And they didn't even try and hide it. I think they called them IMAX or something. Like, it was really similar. He tried to take them to court. And the best they could get from the Chinese courts was that, okay, we won't open any of these anywhere but on the ground in China. So Rich continued to do business. It's actually been a very big move for IMAX to do that, because people flood the IMAX screens because there's nothing like IMAX, even the knockoffs. But he's absolutely right.
Right. I want you to hear. So you asked this question to Larry Fink. Why are we letting these Chinese stocks go on our stock exchange? And he's the CEO of BlackRock, Cut 46.
But delisting Chinese stocks from U.S. stock markets?
That's not a good step in the right direction, because that creates a permanent schism.
So you'd say do it.
I would say don't do it.
Don't do it.
Yeah, and I don't know what that will do. I mean, we're talking about companies like Alibaba. I'm not quite sure how that will play out. Look, if the U.S. deems one of the Chinese companies is doing nefarious things against the United States, those companies should be delisted. I'm not trying to refer that, but if they're going to be just throwing out all the companies that, you know, some of them are owned by entrepreneurs like Alibaba, was a privately, grown company like Tencent. There are some big companies that are in the technology side that that were grown and created by entrepreneurs in China. Mm-hmm. So we should look at this carefully, but we should not throw out everything, because we're going to just build a deeper hole.
So I thought right away, why are we on the stock market? You asked the question, and he said, don't do it.
Right.
It'll permanent schism. Number two, investors, it sounds like to me, investors like investing in there, and we want to make a profit.
Scorched earth is what Larry said, in essence. I think then he said, get rid of the ones that are nefariously operating here in the United States. Well, then the question becomes, why on the one hand are senators like Tommy Tuberville saying, get these things off of U.S. exchanges? And by the way, Americans have huge exposure in their portfolios to names like Alibaba.
So we're hurting ourselves.
Yeah, exactly. You're hurting investors. But let's just go with
401ks.
Oh, my gosh, yes.
There you go. So.
Yeah. But, he's in essence saying get rid of those. But then you get the different message from President Trump, who says we want to save TikTok. Well, TikTok's been proven by bipartisan congressional committees to be trying to destabilize relationships in America, trying to destabilize our population.
You're 100% right. It should be banned tomorrow.
Yes.
And I'm sure if I look at the news,
and
feed,
believe me,
I
love TikTok. I'm on it. I do market hits. I got 250,000 followers.
Do me a favor,
come
then.
On.
Have you and your friends, because I don't go on it, just say, what does your news feed look like? Because when things get hot with China, do you think we're going to have a lot of pro-Taiwan, pro-American stories? They're going to manipulate the news feed.
Mm-hmm.
It's
That's
not
what
just
they do.
Your algorithms that give you the sales you want and the cars you want to see and the people you want to follow. It's the news feed that scares me more than as much as giving up your own IP.
I'm not on that much. My staff, my team for the Clayman Countdown, they trend very young. They said, geez, Liz, this was 2 days ago, and I said, we got to do this story. Suddenly their feed is being populated with people who look American saying, oh, I got this knockoff LVMH, this Louis Vuitton purse, and I got this for half the price, and and I got this real one for half the price. Just go on this Chinese website. That is not coming from the United States, I guarantee you.
That is key. And that's what Trump should realize. There's not going to be any pro-Trump stuff on TikTok. It'll help you win the election, but it's not going to help you govern. I'll tell you what, Liz Clayman, always great to have you on. I look forward to your show today at 3 o'clock Eastern time on Fox Business. Hold on tight, America.
You bet.
Right. We're down 124, but hopefully that'll turn around. Don't move.
Increasing your intelligence quotient.
What the hell did you just say?
It's Brian Kilmeade. A talk show that's real. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
I just landed at the airport in San Salvador a little while ago. I'm now en route into the city.
Looking forward to meeting with the team from the American Embassy. As I've said before, the goal of my visit is to talk to people here about the release of Kilmar Grego Garcia. I told his wife and his family I would do everything possible to bring him home, and we're going to keep working at this until we're successful. I also hope to have the chance to meet with him, but we'll have a better idea if that works out a little later on.
So that gets this straight. The senator from Maryland, who just had Rachel Morin, convicted killer, legal immigrant killer, convicted on Tuesday, is now proud to be on Wednesday in El Salvador trying to help an illegal immigrant who's been linked to MS-13 get free. Patty Morin, cut five.
I'm very angry. I'm actually outraged, but I'm too sad at the moment to show anger at the same time. There was no action on the Democratic Party in any way, from Joe Biden, Kamala Harris, Mayorkas, anyone here in Maryland. None of the senators did anything to help search for the murderer of my daughter.
Right. Nobody searched. And not only that, they didn't help ICE. Local authorities not allowed to help ICE track down the murderer. They almost got away. And we find out the guy sneaked across, was a criminal in his own country. And now he we have to house him in jail the rest of his life in a maximum security prison after brutally murdering a mom of five. But it's okay. Let's focus on this illegal immigrant who was smuggled here at 16, arrested at 19, and deported at 23. Quick note, I want to see you in the audience in Dayton, Ohio, June 21st at the Victoria Theater, History, Liberty, and Laughs with Fox Nation. On August 23rd, I'm excited. I'm going to be in Dallas, Texas, the Winspear Opera House. That's August 23rd. And Richmond, Virginia, September 27th at the Dominion Energy Center Carpenter Theater. BrianKilmeade.com for tickets.
I'm Dana Perino. This week on Perino on Politics, I'm joined by the founding partner at Cavalry LLC and co-host of the Ruthless podcast, Josh Holmes. Available now on FoxNewsPodcast.com or wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
Listen to the show ad-free on Fox News Podcast Plus, on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music with your Prime membership, or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.